In August 1981, a few dozen women and some men and children walked 160 kilometres from Wales and began the Greenham Common Women's Peace Camp. It was to become one of the longest protests in history. Thousands of women from around the world taking a stand against nuclear weapons, some of which were to be sighted at the Royal Air Force Station at Greenham Common in Berkshire. A documentary directed by Auckland-based Briar March called Mothers of the Revolution tells the story of what narrator Glenda Jackson calls the ordinary women who helped end the Cold War. One of them was Dr. Rebecca Johnson, who lived at the camp for 5 years. She went on to found the Acronym Institute for Disarmament Diplomacy. She received the Nobel Peace Prize in 2017 for her work across a range of anti-nuclear organisations, including the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN, of which she was founding president. I asked Rebecca Johnson how she got to Greenham Common.
Well, I had got a job teaching for 2 years in Japan, where one of my sisters was living. And I took the train, in fact, all the way back from Japan, well, via Beijing and Moscow, of course, because I was going to do a master's degree looking at US-Soviet relations and the Far East, and also women's political participation in Japan. But I was really shocked when I got back to England that all my friends who had never really talked much about nuclear weapons were all going on marches and talking about this new generation of nuclear weapons called cruise missiles, and that these ones were being brought in by NATO as part of, you know, upping the ante, if you like. That, you know, they were threatening war, essentially. And the more I read into that, the more concerned I became. And I went on a demonstration. I was, by that time, a student at the School of Oriental and African Studies. I went on a demonstration in London, and it was quite a lot of, you know, your traditional sort of shouty men. But I heard one woman's voice, and it cut through all the noise. And she was talking about some women who had gone to the first of the NATO bases, the US base at Greenham Common, to try to stop the first of the cruise missiles from being deployed. And that they had walked from Cardiff in Wales, and I'm of Welsh extraction. And there was something about the passion with which she spoke about, we haven't got time to waste. We have to stop these deployments because we have to stop nuclear war. So, you know, I didn't immediately go down to Greenham because I was interested in my studies and I was, you know, but I couldn't get it out of my mind what she'd said. And so I did go and visit Greenham. And I talked to the women there. And I'd gone with some friends, and we all went back to London, and we were talking all the way back. And then I started to have nightmares. And my nightmares were of London looking like Hiroshima looked after the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima, but with just that atomic bomb dome of Hiroshima that's very famous, but out of my window in my student flat on the fifth floor, out of my window in the distance, what I could see was the dome of St. Paul's, like that Hiroshima dome, and everything between complete rubble. And I couldn't get that out of my mind. So after I did my exams, I loaded up my motorbike and went down to Greenham thinking, and I actually went there on Nagasaki Day, and I just wanted to sort of commemorate Hiroshima and Nagasaki by going to Greenham. But of course, it wasn't about commemoration, or at least it wasn't just about commemoration. It became clear to me, you know, within hours really of listening to women speak, that we were trying to stop nuclear war. And we needed to do everything we could within our power to do that. And so I was there for about 3 days, and I thought, I have to get ready to be there for longer. So I went back to London, packed my little portable typewriter and a bunch of books, because I'd done my exams, but I still had to write my master's thesis, which I actually ended up writing while at Greenham, awaiting, in fact, a trial for occupying the sentry box, which was my first ever action, which the Welsh women had initiated on the anniversary of the march leaving Cardiff on the 27th of August. A group of wonderful Welsh women from the Welsh Valleys had come to Greenham, and they basically said, we want to take the action into the base. And they'd had the idea we should occupy the sentry box.
This was to prove that the Defence Minister, Michael Heseltine, was wrong when he said, nobody can get in there. It's absolutely secure. It's got fences and it can't be breached.
No, that came much later.
This that was the control
what I'm talking
tower.
About now.
Right, right.
Yeah, yes. What I'm talking about was my first action was walking through the main gate. And when the police came up and grabbed one of the women from the camp that they obviously thought was our leader, the rest of us ran and occupied the sentry box. And it was a relatively short action, but it was the first time that women had apparently actually gone into the base rather than being arrested for camping outside the base.
How many times were you arrested in total?
Oh, goodness, I don't know. I think... But during the period from mid to late 1982 through to 1987, when in fact we got the treaty, the US-Soviet treaty called the INF, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, the treaty that actually got rid of the Cruise and the Pershing and the SS-20s on the Soviet side that were this most destabilizing class of nuclear weapons. And when that happened... I felt that I could actually leave Greenham, but I think I probably served about 12 sentences in all, mostly at the famous or maybe infamous Holloway Prison in London, which is where the suffragettes kept being locked up for trying to get the vote. So I was at Greenham for 5 years. And so I saw a lot of changes during that time. And, you know, when we occupied the sentry box, and there's just a few photographs, there's a little bit about that. And what you see is me coming out of prison with the Welsh women and us singing. And we went from that 2 weeks later to that extraordinary, amazing action of Embrace the Base. And that was when 35,000 women responded to what was essentially a chain letter to them.
Extraordinary, isn't
that
it?
That we initiated.
You had a kind of a phone tree going on. That's described in the documentary. Yeah. And I found myself wondering, what on earth could you have done with social media?
Well, yeah, we obviously didn't have that. We didn't even have phones. You know, we did at one point when there was the cruise missiles actually going out, we got CB radios for each gate, and also I had one in my car and a couple other women had in their car, and that was when Cruise Watch developed, but that's jumping right ahead. But when the time that the Embrace the Base was very powerful, and because that's the first time that we went large, that really it was 15 women living at the camp and a few women in places like, you know, London and Southampton and Wales, who just, you know, work to make that idea, embrace the base on Sunday, close the base on Monday. And it was the exact anniversary of the NATO decision to put the cruise missiles into Europe. And so it was symbolic and it was very active. And because I'd just come out of prison, the women at camp kind of decided to choose me to be the person to talk to the media on that particular action. So that, which is why quite a lot of the footage at that time was me trying to tell the media what we were doing. And that was so weird looking at that in the film. I'd not seen any of that footage because I lived at Greenham by that time, full time. Didn't have a TV. You know, I'd never seen
it. You'd never seen it.
No, I was looking impossibly young.
The media, of course, was largely not sympathetic. And there was a great deal of misogyny, demonization. Mm. You were described as, you know, misfits and malingerers and bad mothers and man-haters. How did that affect you? Were you aware of that kind of demonization when you were there?
Oh, yes, because we had vigilantes would drive past and not only shout stuff, but throw stuff at us. And unfortunately, one of these vigilantes worked in an abattoir. So what they threw was sort of blood and offal, and then that would get maggots and we'd have to burn, you know, and that happened to my very first bender, the igloo-like shelters that we tried to live in that did get evicted. But my very first one was actually destroyed by vigilantes and fire. We also had the squaddies going in and out and making lots of obscene gestures, and some of them would also shout at us. On the other hand, we also had situations where on really cold days when, you know, there would be layers and layers of different, you know, because the Americans were in control inside the base. But when the cruise missiles came, then they put a whole row of British squaddies that did tours of duty in Northern Ireland and then would come and do a tour of duty at Greenham. And so they were pretty tough and they started off being very abusive towards us. But by and large, what happened was that at various gates, a number of women started to cut the fence to hand them through cups of tea. And that sort of changed the dynamic in some ways with them. And the local police, we ended up, because we were going in and out of Newbury Police Station, Newbury Nick, as we called it, the local police had kind of got to know us and got to know quite a few of us. But whenever there was a really big action, they had the Met Police come. And the Met Police were really pumped up and very violent, and used to do all kinds of really vile things, you know, grab us by our ears, by our breasts, you know, by one leg, throw us into a van. And then, you know, I got locked in a van once where I had stopped a cruise missile convoy near Stonehenge when it had gone out on exercise, and with a whole group of women and, in fact, some cruise watch men. But the police sergeant that grabbed hold of me, instead of just pushing me to the side where all the other protesters were, he pulled me into the center of the roundabout, and then he just started kind of bouncing on my back till I lost consciousness. It was really scary. And then afterwards, when he could see people coming to get his number because they'd actually seen it, I was, you know, picked up and bodily thrown into a van. The police all jumped into the van after me because they had to go after the cruise missile convoy because they were there to guard the cruise missiles until the cruise missiles went into the military area on Salisbury Plain. So I was stuck in the van with these men talking about raping me. And, you know, you see a little bit of that in the film with Chris. And the reason why you can see the thing, what happened with Chris, is that she was so determined to actually take a complaint against the police about that. And she succeeded and she got an apology. But it used to happen a lot to a lot of us. It's just that hardly any of us were in a position to, we told each other, but we didn't, you know, take those complaints because, in fact, that kind of misogyny and that kind of violence against us was almost routine. But the point for us was that we had to do this to stop the huge patriarchal violence of nuclear war. And that was the bottom line. And to do that, that meant we knew that we actually had to get the governments to negotiate and ban and get rid of the nuclear weapons, starting with cruise missiles and the Pershing in Germany, and also the SS-20s on the other side. But we were always about getting rid of all the nuclear weapons in the world. The question you asked earlier, what was significant about the air traffic control tower, which I guess was probably my favourite of my well, no, the dancing on the silos was a wonderful action. I loved that one.
Yes.
That was at dawn on New Year's Day in the drizzly rain. And we didn't think we were going to get in, but they were asleep. You know, we got in and we got to the top of the missile silo that was going to be housing the cruise missiles. But Air Traffic Control Tower was very significant. It was after I came back from being part of the plaintiffs taking the court case in New York on the, you know, the Green and Women Against Cruise versus Ronald Reagan and the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the US. And that court case, which is covered in the film, I ended up being stuck out in New York when the first cruise missiles were flown in. And of course, deep down, I think we'd always known, you know, they're the biggest nuclear power in the world. They were going to be able to fly them in over our heads. But we still hoped that somehow we could have stopped them with a court case. It was just, we were trying everything. And a court case was one of the strategies, one of the tactics to try to raise awareness and get this stopped.
It sounds very much like it was, you know, the best of times, the worst of times. I'm fascinated by the kind of intersection between the peace movement, the dedication to get these cruise missiles out of the UK, and what you could regard as not only feminism, but lesbian liberation, and the intersection between those two things. Do you think that some women were there for reasons other than stopping nuclear war, per se?
That's an interesting question, in that, yes, I think particularly in the early days, most of us who went there because we were wanting to prevent nuclear war. But we were also women, and we were drawn to Greenham because there was a strong feminist, eco-feminist sort of energy about what was going on. And it was extraordinarily creative. I mean, some of us, you know, who'd gone on those demonstrations earlier, it was walking from A to B and shouting. And it wasn't, you know, there was a creativity and a disruptiveness about what was happening at Greenham. But at the same time, I became very conscious that when we'd have conversations about what we were going to do and nonviolence and stuff, a number of women were increasingly from really after Embrace the Base, when we were vilified as burly lesbians in the tabloids. I think quite a lot of lesbians looked at that and said, oh, we better go down there because those women need our support. Right. And I happen to know, and you know, quite a number of women that, you know, came to Greenham after that time. It wasn't that they were not against nuclear weapons. They were also against nuclear weapons. And this is something that it has to be understood about Greenham. We may have gone down for different reasons, but we stayed for multiple reasons. You know, I was going to say about the nonviolence. When we'd be talking about nonviolence, a number of women would speak up and say, I am not going to lie down in front of some police about to do me violence. I have had enough violence from my dad or my uncle or my husband, or, you know, they had patriarchal violence in a very direct domestic way. And they were saying, so we better come up with a better way to do it. And that's how we got into, well, what would make you feel empowered? Because if you're not feeling empowered when you're trying to blockade a nuclear base or stop nuclear weapons, then you're actually not being nonviolent, because you're harming yourself by disempowering. So We'd get up and we'd dance. We'd get up and we'd weave the gates shut. And the singing could be very, very powerful, or it could be very calming. It could be different kinds. We learned to use our voices, our bodies. Really, at that point as well, a lot more women started really planning actions that would directly disrupt the military deployment of the crews, even before they came in. And that's what the air traffic control tower was about. Because I got back from New York and everybody was just like shell-shocked and actually quite miserable. And a young woman called Spider, who was living in one of the camps on the north side, very close to the air traffic control tower, I'd got talking with her. And she said, you know, they've just started putting up some scaffolding just on the lower level of the air traffic control tower. She said, but I've been watching. I think we could climb up the scaffolding and then climb up the rest of the way. We can get into the air traffic control tower. So basically, she and I went there. I had a look and I said, you're right. She was only about 18, 19. And she said, well, will you come with me? And I said, yes. Let's plan this. And then we decided that three was the right number. So we chose one of the American women living at the in the camps, Liz. So that was what was planned. And we planned it for 2 days after Christmas because we wanted to put up a big banner sheet that said peace on earth and hang it from the outside railing. But the political reason was that Heseltine had stood up in Parliament after the cruise missiles, the first 16 or 32 cruise missiles had been brought into Greenham. He was asked questions in Parliament about, will you guarantee that these women are going to be safe and that they aren't going to be shot? So he first of all said, no, I have given the Americans no such guarantee, you know, that they can't shoot the Greenham women, was essentially. But he also said, but of course, the Greenham women will not be able to get anywhere sensitive within the base, because the cruise missiles are now there. And that was why we went into the air traffic control tower. And that's why as well, we couldn't just go there, hang the banner and come out again. It was actually a Guardian journalist, Jean Stead, outside. I can say this now because she sadly has passed. That was a good friend. And I had told her that we wanted to do this and we wanted kind of to have proof that we'd done it. But of course it was dark, so her photographer didn't get very much, I don't think. But the point here is we kept changing the actions as the military changed what they were doing. So when the cruise missiles actually came in, then most of our actions were really focusing on disrupting the cruise missiles and their exercises on the roads, on the public roads. And also political, you know, far more political. We made a lot of solidarity with the various bases in around, you know, Germany and the Netherlands and Italy and Belgium and that, because they were beginning to face the same things because they had cruise missiles coming in there. We also followed up from the amazing actions that you see in Moscow with Olga Medvedkova and Carmen.
The risk that Olga took was immense. I mean, she'd seen her husband disappear for speaking out. You know, yes. The USSR at that time was a monolith when it came. You know, one couldn't have dreamed of a Greenham Common taking place in the USSR. This whole period was so, so heightened. You had the Falklands War, lest we forget, going on around this time. I wondered whether you'd ever been so energized, whether you have ever been so energized in your life as during these years?
I'd never been so frightened in my life. And also, I had never...
You mean frightened about the nuclear issue or frightened about your personal safety?
Both. The personal is political. But the violence used against us was pretty daily in various different kinds of ways. And, you know, and some of this, it was sexual violence, but also, of course, it was the patriarchal violence that was destroying the earth. But at the same time, I had never felt so alive. And I also I never learned so much. I have to say this because you're calling us from New Zealand. And one of the most powerful things that happened was women came over from Australia and New Zealand telling us about what nuclear testing had done to the Pacific. We had Japanese women like Setsuko Thurlow, who has become a very dear friend of mine now, you know, because I'm obviously part of the international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons, ICAN. I just got my report on the treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons and its implications for the UK. I just launched that a week ago for the 1 year anniversary, the banniversary, we say, of the treaty entering into force. And kudos to New Zealand for being one of the heavy lifters, you know, the countries that really took the lead to make this treaty work. We've obviously got to make it work fully, but at least we've got the legal normative ban and we can add the other work on. That's what my report's about. But from the Pacific, I met women like Titiwhai Harawira, who, you know, a Maori woman who was just so strong in talking about, you know, nuclear colonialism, and women from, you know, the Marshall Islands, from Rongelap, women, Aboriginal women from, you know, Australia, from Maralinga, where the UK, to its utter and eternal shame, did those horrendous plutonium testing trials where they pretended that there was a dirty bomb that, you know, that blew up, not quite like a total explosion, but caused enormous contamination. Where did they do it? They did it on Aboriginal lands at Maralinga, where people were living. And all of that, you know, and then the UK tested in places like Nevada, and the Russians tested at Kazakhstan, and the level of birth defects there. And we made common cause where we could, as we did with the people in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. You know, in 1985, I was part of a second wave of Greenen women that went to Moscow. And actually, we waited out. It took us 6 hours of waiting, sitting on the steps at the bottom of Olga Medvedkova's block of flats, accompanied by KGB, until they finally had to reduce their numbers. And half of us, we sat there, we talked to them and we sang and all that, but 6 hours. And then there was a moment when they were down to just two. And so half of us got through the door and ran up, and we met Olga then. That's when I met Olga. And she had a tiny baby with her. She had her son and a baby. That's the baby that I met on the launch in London for this film, that she talked about, where her own lawyer said, "You're going to go to prison. You do not want to be having your baby in prison. You'd better get an abortion." And where Olga told him, "No, I'm not going to get an abortion." Well, 2 years after the events that were shown on the film, there was a group of us Greenham women still going there to connect, make connections and give solidarity, and to challenge the Soviet side to start getting rid of their SS-20s.
I'm talking to Dr. Rebecca Johnson about the documentary Mothers of the Revolution, which describes the Greenham Common Women's Peace Camp in mainly the 1980s. I'm guessing that if you hadn't drawn attention to Olga Medvedkova, that the Soviet government would have treated her much more harshly, would in fact have sent her to prison.
I think that's true. I think that is where having that connection with the Greenham women. Remember, if you see the pictures, there were only a couple of women in that group of the trust group. Most of them were men. But the Greenham women wanted to connect with the women, and it gave a different sort of picture. And the fact that the Soviets had on their TVs Greenham women, and they'd been hailing us as heroines. There was a poster somebody showed me that actually looked very much like me and a couple of other women on top of the nuclear weapons silos. You know, me with my hair flowing and my cape, which I was kind of known for. And And they were treating us like heroines. This poster that somebody showed me in 85 was like, you know, support the heroines of Greenham Common. Well, I didn't want to be somebody's PR. I wanted the Soviets to get rid of their nuclear weapons. You know, I wanted all nuclear weapons. And so we were always very clear about that. Mm-hmm. But we also all took up, you know, when the Australian women like Zoll came and told us, and then we raised money and we brought direct survivors of British and US and French nuclear testing over to Greenham. And when, you know, we got a lot of survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, like Setsuko, come over, we listened and we created platforms for them. And I'm so glad that that's also in the film. I learned a lot. It meant that when I left Greenham in 87, what I wanted to do was the next step after INF, for me, was to ban nuclear testing. And actually, that's pretty much what I got involved in doing. And I even managed to turn that into a job. I mean, I had a criminal record as long as your arm by that time. So I couldn't easily go into establishment jobs, but somehow managed to use the skills I had. You know, I studied physics. I'd got my master's in international relations. Greenham was a great training ground to be a strategist and an activist with a really good strategic understanding about what you have to do, you know, to get where you want to go to. And that's why I always say that the nuclear ban treaty, the TPNW that we now have, it's a feminist humanitarian treaty. It has its roots going right back to Greenham and also the humanitarian disarmament that sort of movement that got rid of the landmines and the cluster munitions. And the doctors right back from the 1950s, and certainly the doctors were incredibly important in the 1980s, in highlighting nuclear winter and the climate destructiveness of nuclear winter. All of these streams led to the founding of ICAN, which in its turn led to, you know, the cooperation with governments and the strategy to get the nuclear ban treaty that also requires the total elimination of nuclear weapons. We ain't just stopping getting rid of one generation of crews, Pershing and SS-20s out of one region, Europe, which is what the 1987 treaty did. We went on and we banned nuclear testing. We went on and we've actually banned nuclear weapons. Now we have to stop them being used. It's one thing to get the legal ban that says you mustn't use them. We have to make that work, but we do that by us as civil society activists working with governments, but also pushing at governments. And we do that also by connecting up all patriarchal violence, the violence against the world through nuclear weapons, the violence against the earth, our mother nature, our mother earth through climate, military, industrial, climate destruction, the violence against women and girls through that direct male violence, sexual violence that so many women and girls, including myself, have survived. But, you know, one thing I love in the film is it does tell our story through these stories, four particular stories that people can connect with. But it ends on this most amazing kind of call to action. And there you see these young women from all over the world, from Africa, from you know, Black Lives Matter, from, you know, Greta Thunberg, who, you know, just founded, you know, school strikes and kids coming out all over the world. And you know, Rose McGowan, who took on the powerful Harvey Weinstein in the film industry. And, you know, and the women who started Me Too and then connected up with what, you know, was happening. This is the call to action, and it's a connection. You know, I don't feel like I'm a mother of the revolution, because in a way I felt I was a daughter of the suffragettes. But when I saw the end of that film and I thought, well, this is the generation of our daughters and even our granddaughters, and look what they are taking on in the world. You know, climate destruction, climate justice, discrimination, They're still having to take on violence against women. We are all still having to take on violence against women. We're still having to take on preventing nuclear war. We're absolutely having to take on preventing climate destruction. And we're trying to make peace and justice.
Do you never feel overwhelmed by the scale of the problem? I mean, you've effectively described the challenge, and you can be either energized by those challenges or you can be defeated. Do you never feel defeated by the mountain that always lies ahead?
Every so often, I do. Yeah, things happen. You know, I wouldn't be human if I didn't sometimes. There's a song, you can't kill the spirit. She is like a mountain, old and strong. She goes on, and on. You can't kill the spirit. And now, that is a song that a First Nation American woman wrote, and it's got verses that I didn't even know at Greenham. I only knew how to sing that part of it that I just sang. But it makes me feel, you know, that we can still keep climbing the mountain, even if we get knocked partway back down it, you know, and we are part of nature. We're part of the mountains. We're part of the trees. They nourish us. We tried saving the trees that were all the way, the ancient common land, and Greenham was restored as common land. And then, you know, in my life, you know, again, you talked about lesbians. Well, I got the courage to come out as a lesbian at Greenham because we were already being all vilified as lesbians. I came from a very religious family, or at least, you know, parentage, Hutterite, Bruderhof, it's in the name. I couldn't tell my family, but I fell in love when I was at Greenham. And rather extraordinarily, 15 years ago, I fell in love with another Greenham woman that I don't even remember when she was at Greenham, because she was one of the Bluegate women that partly went to Greenham because she wanted to have fun surrounded by lots of women. But she's now a lawyer, and we met again 15 years ago, and we've been together ever since. And
I suppose that's the most fascinating thing about it to me, is that Greenham was so personally and politically formative, although, of course, as you say, the personal is the political.
Mm. It really was. And also, I think if any of us are going to be dealing with any of these issues, it's not an either or. You can't work on climate without working on military industrial and preventing nuclear war, because, you know, as the climate's destroyed, we'll be getting more and more of the kind of security pressures and threats to do with, you know, resources, to do with areas of the world becoming either inundated so people can't live there anymore and so they have to move. And then migrants get demonized because the places that they've been living are destroyed by, you know, they can't grow their food because of desertification or the loss of the land. Proxy wars done by the big all of the nuclear armed states, make no mistake, they are the largest military industrial polluters as well. And so of these connections have to be made. And it's because I feel that I feel I can't stop, but I can have fun. I can fall in love. I can, you know, nonviolence is also about looking after ourselves and looking after each other. And at Greenham, we really tried to do that no matter what happened.
Let me ask you about the exclusively female aspect of it. I know that there were men involved in Cruise Watch, but Greenham Common was female. Do you think that the issues that you've spoken about should remain exclusively female? What's the role of men in your view?
Let me turn it around and say, wherever you look at who has power, you still see a predominance of men. using patriarchal tools of, you know, sort of, you know, use of resources, commercial, you know, growth, all of that sort of driving things. And if you have just one woman leader, you'll get a Margaret Thatcher. But if you start to tip the balance, you might get, you know, a Jacinda Ardern, you know, because, you know, the more women there are, the more we actually change the culture of decision-making, the culture of what is considered important, the culture of how we speak to each other, the culture of how we treat each other, the way in which we make the connections. You know, we're not in silos doing, you know, going after one of the things that are wrong in the world. We're like a spider's web, which was a symbol of Greenham, not just because spiders are indomitable, but because it keeps on being remade and made and it grows, but it's very strong. Each strand is vulnerable, but together we're strong.
And I'm not dismissing, of course, I could never dismiss your analysis. But I have to say that I went to Greenham as a journalist, and it must have been either 82 or 83. And it was completely dominated by lesbians in leather and studs who were very, very angry indeed, and who evidenced hostility to men in a way that no doubt is completely understandable according to your systematic analysis, but at the time was quite frightening. Did you experience that at all?
Yes, and I know what you're talking about. And again, you know, we actually encountered our own challenges. And as Greenham became more famous, it also became a site for one of the culture wars, if you like.
Yes.
Within lesbianism or within feminism, in which there was an aspect that personally I was not comfortable with, and I'm a lesbian. But we also had made the choice that we'd actually try to find ways where we lived together and found ways to respect each other and so on, and build a community. Now, I suspect from what you just described that you were down there at a weekend, because
it was Easter.
It was Easter. Okay. Well, if it was 83, it was probably when there was a very big action that was actually a mixed action, a C&D action that linked up Greenham with the nuclear bomb factories of the UK nuclear weapons, which were at Aldermaston and Burfield. And only the part around Greenham was women only. But of course, for women who wanted for definite to be women only, that was where they went. And I actually myself was, because I was speaking on a truck that was going along that march, and I was also looking for my mum because I knew she'd come down with her local CND group from London. But the weekends did tend to be a time when there was more. Whenever you were at Greenham, it was different, and that's what this film, I think, tries to show, is there's a story of Greenham that's an authentic story for every single woman out of the many thousands who were there. We were all different. We all came to Greenham with our own politics and our own fears and our own experiences. We were at Greenham with those things. We learned from each other. We took on some things and we pushed some things away. And then at different times, we moved on from Greenham. I lived there as my, you know, only address pretty much for 5 years. I saw quite a lot of changes. I struggled with some of them, but I still thought there is a place here for me. I want, you know, I had a woman, you know, scream at me once saying, you don't look like a lesbian, you know, because I had long hair with suffragette ribbons. And I just said, well, deal with it. You know? This is what a lesbian looks like. You know.
I'm presuming that you've contributed to books on Greenham. I'm wondering whether you've written your own. I mean, it's just such a fascinating time.
I've been too busy trying to get the next treaty and then the next treaty and then the next treaty, and also to make a living for myself, because I had to be able to earn once I left Greenham. But now I've got this big report out, 172 pages on the treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons. You know, nuclear weapons are banned. What does this mean for Britain? But there's quite a lot in it for New Zealand, and there's quite a lot in it about the humanitarian impacts, but also about states like Britain that's a nuclear-armed state. I'm still working on that. But now that I've got this humongous report that's taken me quite a while to get my head around what needed to be said and then to finally find a way to say it, and I did get into a very insecure time with that, and I just felt I can't do this. I'm not capable of this anymore, you know. But I picked myself up, and I moved it beyond. And when I moved down to the seaside, I found that my mother had actually put into my sister's attic about 6 boxes of papers that I'd left with her at different times, mostly when I came out of prison, that had never been looked at. And the mice and the squirrels had a bit of a go at some of them. But essentially, they're now here with me, and I'm going to go through them and think about maybe something that would be interesting for people to read. Who knows? I mean, but...
You definitely should do that.
Really? Okay, well, do you think there's...
I think this documentary will not only have made people remember, but also introduced a whole generation of people who had no idea what Greenham Common was. Mm-hmm. And so you could take advantage of that new knowledge to write a fascinating book about your experience there.
Well, maybe I will. But I want to thank Briar, because there she was in New Zealand. She had the imagination 40 years after Greenham actually, you know, the Greenham women arrived at to do this documentary and to understand what we were about and weave the stories together, and then to finish on that high both challenge and call to action for the next generation. And that probably is the part of the film that I love most.
It's great to talk to you. Thank you. Best of luck. Look forward to talking to you again about your book.
Thank you, Kim.
And that was Dr. Rebecca Johnson, who appears in the documentary in cinemas at the moment, I think, and some of you saw it at the festival, called Mothers of the Revolution.